Welcome to season two and another episode of Nature Space with Haythes. I'm Simon King and here to lead you through the captivating stories of our natural world. Today we explore the crossroads of wildlife conservation and investigative media. Joining us is the multi-talented Megan McCubbin, known for her work as a zoologist, TV presenter, photographer, author and conservation champion. And regular listeners, you're in for another enriching journey. And if you're new here, don't forget to subscribe for more inspiring talks from our inspirational guests. Megan, we're delighted to have you. Given your wide-ranging contributions, we're sure our listeners are in for an insightful conversation.
Wow, goodness, what an introduction. Thanks, Simon.
You're more than welcome. You're more than welcome. We've been really eager to have a chat with you, really, and hear more about you. And let's, if you don't mind, let's start with childhood memories, really. All our Nature Space guests have been kind enough to speak about their early years. And I wonder whether you could talk a little bit about yours. So growing up around the Isle of Wight Zoo sounds incredible. And those early days must have kind of fueled your love for nature. So how did that go?
Yeah, they really did. I mean, nature, there was no singular point where I was like, oh, I want to do nature and conservation as a career. I don't have that kind of flip switch memory. But it was just always part and parcel of growing up. You know, after school, on the weekends, I was just out exploring. I was the kid that was always late for class, because if it had been raining, I was on the paths picking up the worms so no one trod on them. So I would always get told off by my teachers because I'd always be late saving the worms and things like that. So it was just, I always had that kind of curiosity and perhaps empathy for animals. And I just always wanted to know more about them. I wanted to know why they fly, how they fly, why they wriggle, how they wriggle, you know, how they communicate, how they interact with each other. Basically, my career stems from just being incredibly nosy about things and just wanting to understand more about it. So, I was just always fascinated. And my bedroom wasn't perhaps what you'd expect of most little girls. I remember these vivid lime green carpets that weren't my choice. I had like blue wallpaper, but that wasn't the most interesting thing about it was the clashing colors. It was about the animals that lived in my bedroom. So I had a tank with a tortoise, I had cockroaches, hissing cockroaches I should add, I had praying mantids, I had the guinea pigs and the gerbils and poodles and things, but I also had snakes and tarantulas and insects and everything in between. Although my mum didn't like to come into my bedroom when the tarantula was out, but she kind of got used to it. So yeah, I mean, I had nature outside in my garden and inside my bedroom. And it was just everywhere. It was just part and parcel of everything I did and that curiosity. So yeah.
It sounds idyllic, really. And that curiosity is kind of, you know, has manifested itself into your professional, what's become your professional career there. So, I mean, I think from a breakthrough perspective, it seemed to me that you presented the undercover tourist inside the illegal bear bile markets. That's for BBC Three in 2017. Don't want this to sound like this is your life and so on, but it's interesting to know how pivotal that was for your career in wildlife TV.
Yeah, huge. I mean, I never imagined or intended to become a wildlife TV presenter. I dreamt of actually being a ranger out in Africa. I wanted to be in the field all day, every day, teaching people about amazing animals. I wanted to show people porcupines. I've always been obsessed with porcupines since I was three and adopted a porcupine called Victor at Marwell Zoo. So I wanted to like show people all these animals and get them to love them as much as I do. And I never intended to go into wildlife media at all until I realized actually that was probably the best platform to get people to love the same things as me, because I could talk to many people in one avenue, which was great. So I knew I wasn't particularly very gifted academically at school. I struggled in many different ways, but I knew that I needed to get practical experience in order to kind of get a successful career in zoology. So I took on internships within the UK, but also abroad. And one of those internships was with an amazing charity who I love and adore today called Animals Asia. And they've got sanctuaries in both Vietnam and China, and they focus on the rehabilitation and rescue of bears that have been trapped in the illegal bear bile farming markets. So I went over there as a behavioural specialist volunteer to try and analyse some of the behaviour of the bears that had been rescued from the bear bile farming industry. And I was out living in southern China for 3 months doing that. And it was the most surreal, life-changing, pivotal experience, because it had some real highs but also some real lows dealing with these bears that have, you know, long-term psychological and physical impacts and scars of what they've been through. But it was brilliant to see them being bears again and learning to play with each other and having fun in the water. Sadly, they couldn't be released to the wild. So it was about making the sanctuary a safe place for them. And that really is what Animals Asia have done.
Can you talk... Can you set the scene a little bit for us? Because we, you know, we hear this bear bile market, and I don't like the sound of that, but what is it? Right. Just, can you just transport me there for a moment? What is it?
Yeah, it's a pretty nasty industry. So it's typically Asiatic black bears, which are also called moon bears. And they've got this kind of crescent shaped moon white marking on their chest, and they've got Mickey Mouse ears. So they're pretty adorable. And that is the main species that's involved. Right. But you also can see this with Tibetan brown bears, sun bears, and so on. But essentially, bear bile farming is the practice of keeping these bears in tiny cages, often so small that they are unable to turn around. And they can be in these cages for their entire lifespan, up to 30 years. So it's a pretty long time to be kept in a cage. They are typically kept in people's garages, or even, I've seen it even in people's kitchens. And what happens is, when there is a demand or a buyer for bile, which is a liquid that is stored in the gallbladder just above the stomach, then there are different methods of doing it, but essentially the bile is drained from the gallbladder of these bears. Either happens, you know, when the demand is there, or happens on a daily or weekly basis through different types of catheters, either catheters that are inserted and are in there permanently, or the bear is lightly anaesthetized and they stick these horrible needles, and they don't really know where these needles are going, so they just jab and hope for the best to get the gallbladder. Causing lots of different kind of abdominal problems and infections and things. It's pretty, pretty nasty stuff. And they're kind of fed on a soup of cheap antibiotics and sludge and leftovers. And it's a pretty sad existence, really. But it is, as I said, as an illegal practice that's underground for the most part. Although, you know, when you're walking through the streets at the bear farming area, it's quite obvious because there are literally bears in cages everywhere. And the bile is supposedly used for inflammation. So it's a traditional medicine that people use it for joints. They use it also for, like a bear Viagra, if you want, just to kind of...
really?
An aphrodisiac kind of thing, which there is no proof to that. But sadly, bile does have some anti-inflammatory properties, but it's not as good, not as strong as plant alternatives. And that's the key thing. So yeah, it's a pretty sad state. Right. These bears live a pretty sorry life, sadly.
This is terrible. So you've got these adorable bears, but to be fair, it shouldn't matter whether they're adorable or not, they're a bear.
Yeah.
And they're being used, they're being farmed then really in terrible conditions for purposes of bile. Partly for medicinal purposes, for inflammation, although you say there are already plant-based materials that could do an equally good job. And then we've got the usual suspects, better job, the usual suspects of ego and generally men's ego, and you know, using this as for the reasons you've mentioned, which is bloody awful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's shocking. It's terrible. And when I was working, volunteering for Animals Asia, I didn't actually visit a farm. So I was kind of dealing with the aftermath of this. You know, we had different big enclosures. I mean, the quality of these bears' lives is probably better, you know, after they've been rescued, obviously not taking into account everything that happened before. But the quality of life that Animals Asia was able to give is, you know, the best captive experience I've ever seen. These bears are so cared for and so looked after. They've got an elaborate enrichment strategy. I think they're probably more enriched than I am most of the time. You know, they've got 4, 5, 6 different new activities to do every day, lots of different scent enrichment, lots of different foods to play around. I mean, they're really, really cared for in the best way possible. I mean, we owe them that. So, you know, to go there and to see these bears... some of them have been rescued as cubs. Some of them have been in the bile trade for 5 years. Some of them had been in the bile trade for 25 years. So you really had these different, mentalities, I suppose, that the bears had. We had one area which is called the special care bears. And these are typically bears that have either had severe infections. You know, they've had to have limbs amputated because sometimes they're caught in the wild with snares. So, you know, they have to have one of their paws or legs taken off. That they're mentally scarred. I think that's probably the biggest thing. It's just kind of getting them through that and getting them to feel comfortable and safe and secure. And they're typically solitary animals, but they live in big groups in Animals Asia. They can survive quite happily together. And to see them playing with one another in the water was really heartwarming. But at that point, I didn't know the full extent. I mean, I'd seen what happens in bear farms. I'd done my research, but I hadn't experienced it myself. And it was when I got back from my 3-month internship that I got contacted from a friend of mine at the BBC who was working on Undercover Tourist, which is a series about how close tourists can get to illegal wildlife trade without really knowing it. And they said that they had a story fall through. And at this point, I was in my final year of university, so I was quite busy with my dissertation and everything else. I'd just about to start that back up again. Mm-hmm. But I said, no, this is, why don't we do bear bar farming? And I think it was a couple of weeks later, I was on a plane and we were out and I was experiencing life inside a farm for the first time. And I was stood, you know, surrounded by bears in cages, and it absolutely broke my heart. However, that is also the most powerful motivation that I've ever had. If I've ever needed a kick to say, right, get on with it, raise awareness for this issue and you know, try and help animals in these situations. I mean, that was it. And those are some pretty horrific memories, but they're ones that will kind of fuel me on probably for, well, forever.
Yes. Yeah. I can hear that. And so it really was a true pivotal moment that made you think, you know, you've escalated here. You've raised the game from saving earthworms. And here you are, you know, being exposed to something that you can see that's what I imagine is, you know, a mass scale and very frightening. So it's changed something in you that you've gone, I think at that point are you saying, right, I need to, now I know this, I need to do more about it. And had you decided professionally that you want to do more about it then? Had you said that this is perhaps my calling?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've always been relatively loud, relatively kind of opinionated, my mother would say. So, you know, why not use my voice to stand up for animals that can't speak up for themselves? You know, whether they're the ones that are trapped in cages, whether they're the earthworm stuck on a path, whatever it may be. You know, we have a responsibility here to do what we can to save these creatures, especially when we're the ones entrapping them in cages. We're the ones bleeding them with bile. You know, we're the ones exterminating their habitat. We're the ones causing the harm. So I think we have a duty, a responsibility to, you know, protect the habitats, to reinstate biodiversity the best we can and care about animal welfare and conservation to a degree that we haven't cared necessarily enough about before. So I think for me that is crucial, and I'll always use my voice to stand up for the animals that don't really have one.
Will it become challenging for you? I imagine it will. As your profile, let's say professionally, you know, increases and more people become aware of you, but also, you know, you want to continue to stand up for nature. Does that become a challenge, really? How do you keep using that strong voice that you've got, that opinionated, your opinionated nature? You know, does that come into conflict with what channels want you to say? You know, I imagine they want you to stick to a script, which of course, you know, you have to. But also outside of the broadcasting world now, we're on this 24 hours never switch off in terms of, you know, my children and other people's children will get their news from social media, for example. So, you know, when you have a following, the temptation is for you. Well, I imagine it's not just a temptation. You want to tell it how you feel it is. Do they come into conflict?
I think less so, actually, going forward, because we are in a critical point in time. I think, you know, if I was creating a fuss about nothing, I mean, I don't create a fuss about nothing. I don't have the energy or the time to do that. Then they possibly would do. But, you know, we're at a critical point in time where we can't argue about the science. We can't argue about the fact that our climate is quite literally on fire. As we're talking right now, there's fires raging across the world. There are floods. There are droughts. There are species coming extinct at a much faster rate than we've ever seen before. And it is, you know, ultimately on our shoulders, because we are the ones that have created the harm, but we're also the ones to fix it. So if we can't be voicing our opinions now, then when can we? We need to be talking about this. We need to be raising our profile and discussing it. And I think more and more people are coming on board with that. and becoming aware that we need to tell the hard truths. But as well as that, we also need to be giving solutions. And the key thing is there are solutions. There is a lot to be hopeful about. There are some amazing people doing some amazing work. And as long as we are, you know, saying what's going wrong, but also offering, countering that with something that we can all do as individuals, as communities, and as, you know, countries and a population on the planet, then actually I think it's become increasingly important to use your voice. And I think because of the profile that I've been so lucky to have, I feel almost more of a responsibility to use my voice in that way and use it wisely.
Yeah, good for you. Well, we'll come on to your book in a little while if we can, because I think that sets us up nicely for that. But first, I thought it would be interesting if you could tell us a little, because so we've jumped to Springwatch, if we can, really, and just thinking about how joining, going from that wonderful bedroom that you presented in terms of the color choice. I think mine was actually equally a little bit disturbing back in the day. But anyway, so now you've joined the Watch series, really. And I just wonder what must it feel like for you? You know, do you have this kind of imposter syndrome, you know, present itself on day one of filming, really? And I just wonder also in its seasonal counterparts, it's not just the Spring Watch, it's the Autumn Watch and so on. And it must have been thrilling. And I just wondered whether you've got any special memories or insights to share, you know, about these iconic shows, really.
Yeah, I mean, the whole experience is absolutely nuts. And I still have to kind of pinch myself that I've even done that, because I, you know, I watched The Watchers quite religiously growing up. And then to actually be on it was just weird. It was very surreal. And I think with these kind of shows, when you're live presenting, you're kind of sort of thrown in at the deep end. I think that's how you have to be, because you never know how you're going to react live until you are live. You can do as much rehearsing as you want, but until, you know, the cameras are rolling and you're very aware that there are millions of people watching you, it's a very different feeling. It's a very different reaction that you can have, because it is very surreal. I remember my first piece that I ever did on Springwatch was during 2020, and it was a piece about birdsong and about how bird brains process information quickly, how they can kind of produce notes and produce song in a very different way than how our brains would necessarily cope with producing song. And I remember it really well. I mean, I wrote notes. I did lots of research for my first item. I did, you know, I dug deep into the background of the science, and I had, you know, pages and pages of A4 talking all about the science of birdsong. And I love it. I wouldn't have time to do that now when I go and do a live item. And I think that was something that really helped me at that point, was to kind of write it all out, really understand all the areas to do with birdsong science. Yes. So that I felt prepared for my 4-minute segment, but I put in hours of work for that, and I think the more you do it, the more confident you grow, and kind of you grow confident in your own knowledge and you know how you're going to react and how you're going to be. But no, it was great fun, and the team at Springwatch behind the scenes is phenomenal. It's you know, you only might see 4, sometimes 5 of us on the program, but there is an army behind the scenes of fantastic producers, researchers, executives. I mean, it is like a huge big family, and it's you know, this year for Springwatch 2023 was the first year that we were pretty much all together. Gillian was off roaming, but you know, Chris, Michaela, myself and the team all had a base RSPB Arn, and it was fantastic to be all together, to, you know, to have meetings. We have a morning meeting where we go through the script and the rough plan for the program for the night, but to do that all sat in one room where everyone could pitch in ideas, and it was a real inspiring creative place, was really, really exciting to see, because it was the first time I'd done it, because before it was lockdown and it was all over Zoom. So it was great.
Yes, but you mentioned scripts and you mentioned live presenting, which I think would frighten anybody. I mean, and but also you mentioned about the team behind you. So I mean, even here in our little podcast, we've got Edward and Juliana who are sat across from me at the moment, who are just making sure I behave myself. Nothing to worry about with you. It's me. They're just making sure I, you know, keep on track and so on. But, you know, you must have been presented. So you say scripts. But one of the things when I did my bit of research on your good self, there was an online article talking about dyslexia. And I just wonder whether you're comfortable to talk about dyslexia. The article I read actually mentioned severe dyslexia. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you know, here you are, you know, the nation's almost the flagship natural history program, several million viewers about to tune in. You're doing all your research, and I'm going to imagine that's how you deal with dyslexia: get your research and make sure you know all there is to know. How do you deal with that? So how do you deal with it, really? How did it affect you in those early school years and beyond? And how are you dealing with it today? What challenges does it create?
Yeah. So, goodness, where to start with this one? So I was never particularly academically gifted in my younger years at school, because I didn't really understand why I was different. And I don't think the teachers understood why I was different. And I'm talking kind of junior school, so the late 1990s, early 2000s. And I was at a school that really didn't understand me. And I overheard the teachers at one point say, well, refer to the table that I was sat on as the stupid table. So you can imagine how quickly I was pulled out of that school and moved to a different one. And there just wasn't the support there for any sort of diagnosis, any sort of testing, anything like that. So eventually when I was seven, I got tested for dyslexia. And yeah, I struggled a lot. I mean, I remember my mum being incredibly frustrated and confused, because on the way to school, she'd drive me to school every morning and we'd go over my times tables and I would get them. I knew them. But then you'd ask me 5 minutes later and they were gone. Like, I just had no recollection or understanding of how to retain those numbers. So numbers for me is something that's quite hard, still is to this day. Someone was talking about maths the other day and I don't, my brain just shuts down. It's like I don't even necessarily try to compute it, because I just, it's a fear thing. I'm like, no, I won't be able to do it, so I just won't. Which is a real shame, because I know I can do it. And if I worked at it and I found the way that I learn, I absolutely could do it. But I think it is just kind of the aftermath, perhaps, of those early school years where I was repeatedly told that, the stupid table, I couldn't do it. So now my brain just shuts down rather than even trying to complete the task. Which is a real shame. And it was also that way in science. I struggled with science for a long time, but I was very lucky that I met Phil Roseblade, who was my out of school dyslexic tutor. And I would go to him on a Wednesday afternoon after school for years. And he really taught me how I learn best. And that's the difference. That's the key here, is that dyslexic people, and there are 1 in 10 people are dyslexic. So it is a very common thing. If you're a teacher, you probably have a dyslexic person sat in every classroom, if not two. So it's not something that's rare or unusual. It's all across our population. And the thing is that people think that dyslexic people don't fit in with the school system. But that couldn't be further from the truth. It's that the school system doesn't fit for dyslexic people. And dyslexic people are just as bright, just as intelligent as everybody else. It's just that we use different parts of our brain for reading, for math, for everything else. And we learn very differently. And that's a beautiful thing, because we see the world differently. We see patterns, we see stories, we communicate a lot more comprehensively than people without dyslexia. So actually, I mean, I see it as a real strong suit, and I wouldn't be without it now, but I've really had to teach myself how I learn best, because I realized it. I'm not the failure here. It was actually a school system that didn't necessarily support. And I get kids coming up to me when I talk about dyslexia. I did a talk the other day, and I had a number of children come up to me saying, I'm dyslexic and here's my story. And a lot of the stories genuinely break my heart, because the lack of support and the lack of understanding out there still is immense, and we're not talking about it as much as we should be. And it takes a lot. I think, you know, I was lucky that I found Phil Roseblade to help me find that confidence. And I worry for kids out there, if they don't have the same support, whether they're gonna think smallly of themselves or think they can't do it, when actually they can. They just don't learn the conventional way, and that's fine.
Yes.
So, you know, I had to relearn everything. And I think in my career today, you know, obviously I do lots of different things. You know, I've just published a book a couple months ago, with my television presenting. I mean, it's all forms of science communication. So I tend to describe myself as a science communicator. And I think actually dyslexia really helps me in that, because I have taught myself. I mean, I love science. I wanted to be a scientist out in the field. You know, my statistical analysis sometimes needs a little bit of updating, you know, sometimes. But I'm fascinated by science. Like, I will read, you know, Nature, which is a big scientific journal. I will read all of the pure science papers, because I just find them fascinating. And I think actually my dyslexia really helps me to pick out the bits that people will find interesting, and helps me to communicate that science in a more digestible way for people, or at least I like to think it does. I mean, I can kind of look at a paper and I immediately strip out the unnecessary complexities that are important if you're in that field but aren't necessary to the story. So, you know, that's I try and actually harness my dyslexia in that way in terms of communication skill. You know, but there's still challenges. I mean, writing a book was absolutely petrifying. I'd sit down and write every single day. And it wasn't that I couldn't do it. I actually really enjoyed doing it. But it was the sitting down and thinking, right, today I'm good. This is my aim. I'll write 500 words or 1,000 words. I mean, I actually did English as an A level and got an A. So English was never really my spelling's a bit questionable. My pronunciation is also very questionable. Sometimes I pronunciate words that I could say yesterday very wrong the next day. So my dyslexia comes out in all different forms, but that's what makes it great and fun and different, because you never know what I'm going to say.
Yes.
Say wrong.
But that creativity there is of all those things you mentioned, it's the creativity is the thing when you look at the impact that AI will have or is having now and will have in the future. It's the creative spark, the spell check and everything else really is a, you know, what doesn't have a spell check on these days? But the creative spark, the ability to filter information, as you talked about, Megan, really, to be able to look at something and to be able to say, well, yes, if you want to read that journal or if you want to read that peer-reviewed science paper, it will take you 3 days. It took me 3 days as well. But here's my filtered view of it. And this is what I think it's saying. Now, as long as that's been true to the science, or giving an alternative argument, great, but you're filtering it. And that's, I think, is why that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you, because we want to talk to people who are out there doing positive things. We like to think we're doing positive things too. But let's talk about this book, if we can. Or your most recent book, which is an atlas of it. I'm telling you, like, you don't know what the title is, but it's for our listeners, an atlas of endangered species. So that came out earlier this year, and I wonder whether you could tell listeners a little bit more about the book, because the thing is that I think Attenborough does this as well with his Blue Planet and so on. You hear all this, you know, for half an hour of things that are, you think, well, we are doomed. We are never going to get. What is the point of doing anything? Because it's too late. So I think he always finishes with, look, I feel quite, there is a way through this. And if I can read a little bit of a piece I saw from Waterstones, just to set the scene, because when I read this, I thought, oh, we are doomed. but I think I'll let you tell us why we're not. So, and I'll just read this piece here. So it says, the diversity of life on Earth is astounding, with each species perfectly adapted to its environment. Sharks can navigate the oceans using electromagnetic fields. Sloths use algae as camouflage. Albatross can fly for hours without beating their wings. And orchopods each have unique cultures and languages. But every hour, species disappear. Our incredible world is at risk. So it sounds solemn. But really, this is a book about inspiring people doing inspiring things. So maybe you'll say a little bit for our listeners.
Absolutely. So the premise of the book was to talk about extinction, because we can't talk about biodiversity without talking about biodiversity loss. And very sadly, that is the situation we are in at the minute, where we're losing 3 species to extinction every single hour due to the anthropogenic human-made threats. So that is, you know, quite an extreme, terrifying statistic. And when I first saw that, I was quite shell-shocked by it, as I think everyone else will be. But I decided, okay, you know, we can learn from our mistakes for the species that have gone already. And we can, you know, try and conserve the ones that we still have better. And I really wanted to talk to the conservationists, the rangers, the scientists on the ground doing the work every single day, who are sometimes putting their lives on the line to protect species on the brink, you know, because we talk about, you know, conservation and saving species, but what does that really mean? How do you go about saving an animal on the brink of extinction? So I interviewed scientists all around the world and rangers as well, around the world who were really fighting tooth and nail for various different species, everything from the exquisite spike thumb frog to lady slipper orchids to northern white rhinos. So it's a mixture of kind of Jurassic Park science as well as kind of community conservation about how we can pull these species back. And the consensus was overwhelming in that absolutely we can. You know, we've seen this happen before with various different species. We've seen this with Spix McCool, Peresky's horses. You know, we see good news conservation stories happen all the time, and these people are the hope. They are the inspiration. They're the ones out there doing the critical work, raising the awareness. You know, so whether that be, you know, looking to save a functionally extinct species like the northern white rhino, or trying to eradicate diseases like in the African wild dogs and so on and so forth. There are people out there fighting really hard. And they all believe it can be done, but they believe it can be done if we start doing something now. And that's, I hope, the message in the book, is that, yes, it's scary. We're all a little bit frightened. We're all a little bit overwhelmed by what's happening to our planet. But that's okay. It's okay to be overwhelmed as long as we use that and harness that energy as motivation to do something about it. Because whilst the problem might seem big, as individuals, if we all do something together, that problem quickly becomes a lot smaller. So whether that's raising, you know, awareness for pangolins, as I say in the book, very few people actually surprisingly still know what a pangolin is. Yeah, it's one of the most trafficked animals on the planet. If we can raise awareness for the pangolin, if we can, you know, put rainforest back, try and conserve our habitats, rewild our habitats, actually, you know, we can go a really long way with individual actions, looking at what we put in our shopping trolleys, to using our voices and holding our government and policymakers accountable for their decisions and asking them to do better for our planet. I think that's probably the key thing, is that, you know, I'm often asked, what can people do to help wildlife? And we can all make our gardens that little bit wilder. We can all, you know, put in hedgehog highways, put in ponds. We can all do that. But I think at this point in time, where we are really seriously on the cusp here, like we are on a fine line, the most important thing we can all do is use our voice to hold policymakers accountable, to ask for that change. Because if we don't change at a bigger level, you know, then we're at risk of losing these species forever.
Did you, you know, what's the common denominator? I mean, our listeners will hear so much about climate change. And obviously one argument is always, well, the climate's always changed. But the problem here is the speed of change and the rate of change. And obviously the fact that our species cannot adapt to that rate of change at the same pace. Is that simply, you know, in terms of climate change, where we are?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's more complex than that. But
yeah, our climate has always changed. You know, we've gone from huge volcanic eruptions to huge glaciers and ice ages. Our planet has got incredibly hot with carbon dioxide, and then got freezing cold again. And it has. We've had many extinction events before. We've had 5 mass extinction events before, which, you know, the most famous, of course, being the one that wiped out the dinosaurs when that meteorite hit. So yeah, of course, our planet has always changed. But the way that we are accelerating things now is unprecedented. We have never seen such a fast change in the planet's history. And this is solely due to the way that we are using fossil fuels, putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and creating kind of a hot box for all these kind of really toxic gases. But we are also, as well as that, we're destroying habitats. We are directly persecuting species which we claim to love. So there's a whole host of different threats going on at one particular time. But the thing that weaves everything together is climate change. So the way that it's moving so fast means that species are unable to evolve to be able to survive. But there is, you know, a simple thing here in that, long after we're gone, I mean, humans will go, I mean, we don't really think about it and we act like it won't happen, but humans are a species that will go extinct at some point. And there are lots of different theories about when that might happen. Some say 10,000 years, some say, you know, I don't know, 100,000 years. So there's lots of different varying factors about when humans might go extinct, but the general consensus is it's not for a long time, so don't panic at this point in time, unless the climate changes that dramatically. But after humans have gone, life will persist. You know, even if we change the planet so much that we wipe out 80-90% of life on Earth as we know it, life will continue after we've gone. species will re-evolve in different climatic conditions, and there will be some different types of life out there. And that life will probably look very different from how it did today, as life is different today than it was when the dinosaurs were alive. Life will always persist. Mm-hmm. It's just whether we want the species that we know and live around to face extinction much faster than they were naturally predicted to or naturally should do. You know, so it's what life we want to see moving forward. You know, are we going to exterminate life as we know it, or are we going to shoot ourselves in the foot by destroying life and really destroying ourselves? And then, you know, life will persist in some way, shape or form, but we probably won't be there to see it. So that's the difference there. Okay. Is that, you know, it's a bit morbid, but it's, you know, it's true.
Yes, this is about, I think you strike me as somebody who's interested in taking action rather than just, you know, talking about things. What are some of the simple things our listeners might do, you know, to make a little bit of a difference? You know, we've all got our small gardens, you know, even if we're in a flat, we have the potential for, you know, for a window box and so on. Some have larger gardens than others, obviously, but what kind of things can we do? What should we be doing? What might we do if we want to play a role? Because my theory is always that these gardens, one single garden may not make that much of a difference. However, all these gardens, you know, joined together create these stepping stones and this super highway for nature and for wildlife. And so people shouldn't feel like they're alone. There are plenty of us who do care about the natural world. So what might you say to encourage them to know that A, they're not alone, B, you know, these are some of the simple things they might do that actually can make a difference. The really big stuff, you know, the nuclear power stations, the rest of it, obviously there's the lobbying and everything else, but perhaps you can give us a couple of, you know, a starters for 10. Where do we go from here?
Well, of course, you know, we can make our gardens wilder, as I mentioned before, you know, leaving an area that isn't necessarily, well, as we deem it, to be neat and tidy. You know, have corners which are wild, allow your grass to grow long, allow different species, you know, bramble and nettle to survive, which is brilliant for butterflies. Put in holes into your fences, as you said. If we have habitat which is connected, then actually it creates a much stronger link for species to survive. So fences are something which kind of causes habitat fragmentation on a smaller scale. We put fences into our gardens and we basically block routes for animals to get to one another, to mate, but also to find resources and shelter. So if we're able to put a hedgehog highway, a hole in our fences, which can be, no, you know, doesn't need to be large, it can be the size of a CD case if people still have CDs lying around. I think it's about 16 centimeters by 16 centimeters. Then
I'll put a picture of an old CD on for those a bit younger than me.
You know, and they can be great for hedgehogs to move around, but also for amphibians and things like that too. Right. Having a small pond does a huge difference. Actually, I think putting a pond into your garden is one of the best things you can actually do for wildlife. And when I say pond, I'm not talking about necessarily anything that's massive. It doesn't need to be big. It could be a washing up bowl that you sink into your lawn, or you could have a pond that kind of sits within a pot, so it's not dug within the ground, but have, you know, a few stones and rocks in there for species to hide, have some branches or twigs so that anything that falls in can get out, put a couple of oxygenating plants in there, and you'll be surprised by how quickly things will come. So of course you can, you know, all those tips to make your garden a little bit wilder, but then there's taking it a step forward and looking at community conservation. So I know that sounds like quite a big thing, but it could be as simple as going and knocking on your neighbour's door and saying, hey, I've put a hedgehog highway in here. How do you feel like doing it with your other neighbour on the other side? And then you can create a link going around your houses and you can create like a wilder street. You know, you could share seeds with each other, grow your own vegetables, start talking to each other about how you can connect your gardens for the benefit of wildlife. So that could be a way of getting into community conservation. You can volunteer. There's lots of amazing charities that you can kind of give your time to kind of help support local wildlife. But as I said before, I genuinely believe that the most important thing we can do is to use our voice. I mean, my MP gets quite used to emails from me every week because I'm constantly emailing him asking, hey, how do you think about this? Could we do this differently? So don't be afraid to contact your representative and talk to them about what changes you want to see within your community. And I think actually you get, well, hopefully, depending on who your representative is, you know, some good responses from that. Not always the response you want to hear, but it's important to put that seed in to start kind of growing those ideas forward. And then the other thing that I would say, and this is a bit of a bigger scale, and people will switch off when I say this word, but I'm going to say it anyway, because I think it's important. We have this negative view of what activism is. I feel like the word activism has almost been, weaponized is the wrong word, but it's been attached to so many negative connotations that when we hear the word activism, we immediately think of groups like Just Stop Oil, Extinction Rebellion, getting arrested on the streets. To me, that is not what activism is. We are all living beings, and therefore we play an active role within our environment. My argument is actually activism can be whatever you want it to mean, and we need to reclaim that word to stop making it such a word which people look down upon, because actually being active means you're standing up and doing something. You're using your voice, you're being proactive at something. Activism for you could mean feeding the birds. It could mean putting in a hedgehog highway. It could mean, you know, going to a peaceful democratic protest. It could mean whatever you want it to mean. But if we don't start standing up and kind of talking about the solutions we want to see, then we might be in a bit of trouble. Well, there's no might about it. We will be in a bit of trouble. But the thing is, we can do it, because if we all stand up and use our voice, then that, as I said before, that problem becomes a lot smaller. We can do this. We are all in this together. We are all passionate, increasingly so, about protecting our environment and making eco-green choices. So we are at the driving wheel. You know, if we want to turn the car left and go down a more eco path, we just have to steer left, and ultimately big companies, politicians and, policies and law will have to kind of move with us, because, you know, we have to make sure that those policies are just and fair in a green world, which we need to survive in.
I love the idea of the community conservation, you know, just knocking on your next door's neighbor's garden. That means no point. You can't put a hedgehog pathway on only one side of your fence. It's got to go on, you know, both neighbors have to subscribe to this. I love that idea. So I guess, you know, that builds up on this stepping stone idea. I think you're right about activism. It frightens many of us, because it feels, you know, perhaps this, you know, it's a challenge word, you know, how it looks in the media, how it brings London to a halt, you know, with traffic and football matches and everything else. But actually, I think here you're talking about activism could be, you know, on a walk with my dog, I noticed that a path is being ripped up and a hedge is being destroyed. You know, that might be something where I, you know, try and make some urgent call to my MP that says, hang on, you know, what's happening here, and so on. And it can be, and I suppose, you know, as you say, taking action for us could be feeding the birds for us. I always feel very, that one thing we wanted to do as a company was to be activists in one specific area, which was our project to move buildings. When we set our stall out to move, what we did was we purchased more land. We're on an industrial estate, and we make no apologies for that, because this land has been given to industry. So we don't, you know, we could, if we moved to the countryside, we could have a purpose-made, you know, country dwelling, and it would look wonderful. We wanted to be on an industrial estate, because that's where we should be. However, what we wanted to do was we wanted to hand back commercial space to nature. So you mentioned ponds, for example. So when you talked about small ponds, my mind flashed back to days when we have spent in Bill Oddie's back garden, really, and we did filming back in the day, and some of Bill's ponds were no bigger than a dustbin lid, and yet teeming with life, much life there. So you're absolutely right. I mean, they don't even have to be ponds, they can be almost like bog gardens, really, but where there's water, generally there's life. We've put two ponds in here. One is our attenuation pond. So instead of having all our drainage underground, we thought, well, let's have a pond, because that will bring life. We've put another pond, which is in front of where our team have their break, so that a team can stay connected with nature. I think a challenge in the commercial world is since COVID, I want to come on to COVID if we've got time, just to talk about the self-isolating bird club as well and the good work that you did with Chris as well to help people. But one thing we've realized is that this entrenched position of people wanting to be work at home, we realize that actually we are this gregarious sect generally, and we're a manufacturer. So we need to be here. But we're thinking, if we need to be here, we want our people to be able to take a break with nature, stay connected with the natural world. And that's why our canteen has a little jetty that steps over water. And we've now done it since we had a chat with Hannah Bourne Taylor, who was on a mission to help Swifts. We put seven Swift boxes up in our 7 meter reefs, and we hope we'll have a colony there at some point. So I think for us, our activism is that we think in a business setting, it's possible to work alongside nature, because we talk about our homes and we talk about what we can do in the countryside. But for us, there's not enough talk about what you can do in a commercial setting. So that's what we're setting out to do. We're going to plant in native species. We're going to rewild areas where we can, or allow nature to take over, which we've done in some areas. I don't think we'll be on the Chelsea Flower Show.
Never know.
But actually, we are saving a few earthworms. So, we're there.
It's a key thing, because a lot of the time you think, okay, well, industry is here, nature is over there. And there's a massive flaw in that psychology, because nature is not there. Nature is we are nature, you know, and therefore really our industry, our business is absolutely part of nature. And we can incorporate that in. So it sounds like a wonderful place. I mean, even just being by a pond, we know that has massive implications for our mental health. It's the blue effect. It makes us feel calm and relaxed. And sometimes you need that when you've got a busy day at work. You need to go and sit by a pond. So the more we can incorporate nature into our everyday lives, whether that's at work or at home, I mean, that's a key thing.
Brilliant. Well, you're always welcome. You can come and see it for yourself. Give us a little bit of time, though. We're still in our early days, but we're getting there, though. I think we moved in April, the end of March. So, well, can we come on to the self-isolating bird club with Chris Packham? So, I mean, this links. It's a nice segue, because we felt it here with our team. Many of our team work from home, but also as a manufacturer, we kept working here because people were connected with nature. They didn't want us to stop supplying them with bird food and so on. But how did this wonderful idea come about, and how did it help kind of reshape? How do you think it's helped your listeners and viewers reshape their bond with nature? Because I think it has left a legacy from, you know, what I can see.
Yeah, it was a really odd time. Self-isolating bird club started in March of 2020, which is probably remembered not for self-isolating bird club, but for the thing we call COVID and lockdown, which we will try and avoid talking about now, because it feels like a million years ago. It was just like a black hole, doesn't it? Of like, I don't know, what happened in that year? I don't know. So I ended up moving in with Chris at the start of lockdown, just because we felt it would be beneficial to work together. I mean, he's my stepdad. I grew up with him, but we obviously work in the same industry, so we do a lot of stuff together. And also, he lives in at that point in time, he lived in a nice house, a little cottage in the middle of the New Forest, so he had access to woodland. And I thought, oh, that'd be quite a nice place to lock down. And obviously, that's a real privilege, and very lucky to have had that open green space. And that's really where kind of self-isolating bird club started, was that we noticed one morning that the celandines had opened, which is a beautiful forest plant species, and the flowers were out, and we took a lot of like comfort in that. It's like, oh, it's nice to know that whilst we're all in lockdown, spring is kind of springing up everywhere, and that's something which is kind of continuing. Life is continuing as normal, or relatively normal if you're not a human being. And we just thought, well, you know, we're enjoying these celandines. Maybe people would also like to see the celandines, people that live in the heart of a city or don't have a back garden or don't have access to woodland, as much as we did. So we just did a kind of a little live segment just on Facebook on a shaky mobile phone. It was really blurry, and the signal in that area was really patchy. So it was very rough and ready. But then every day we started noticing more signs of spring. So we started doing these tiny little things on literally selfie mode on our mobile phone on Facebook, just saying, oh, look what's here. This has opened up today. Or, you know, oh, earlier on, you know, we heard, you know, foxes and the fox cubs are out for the first time. Isn't that nice, kind of thing? Just trying to connect with people. And very quickly, in the space of a matter of weeks, after doing these little tiny live 10-minute segments every day, we had a chat with a guy called Fabian Harrison, who was locked down in Norfolk, so quite far away from where we are, but he was very good technically. And he said, well, we could make this into a miniature show. So that ended up really being what we did. We did an hour a day all throughout lockdown, and even after lockdown, we then went to one a week. And we made lots of different shows connecting with people all over the world, it turned out, just looking at what wildlife is doing in their area. And we started this kind of Facebook group, which grew and grew and grew into kind of a community, and it's still going today. It's called Friends of South Isolating Bird Club today, and people are still talking on it, sharing the nature in the back garden, you know, and meeting up. Actually, people, they're really good friends. Lots of people meet up and do wildlife walks together now.
Really?
So it's really wonderful.
You started a movement.
It's become a really beautiful community, and it feels amazing to have been a part of that. But it wasn't so much, you know, about Chris and I. It was about everyone. It was people coming together to connect at a time where we couldn't, you know, physically connect to each other. We couldn't see each other, but we, you know, we had this forum where we could go and talk about nature wherever we were in the UK or around the world. And we had films given to us from everywhere. It was, you know, amazing. Everything from harpy eagles to rhinos to pangolins to, you know, goshawks and, you know, anything. We talked about anything, and it was a pretty special time in that way, because it felt, yeah, but we kept ourselves busy, we kept ourselves sane through but yeah, it was quite a big undertaking.
Yeah, it must have been. And I imagine it takes it out of you as well, at a time when we're really, it's the natural thing is to think about ourselves, really, isn't it? Become quite entrenched and so on, and yet you guys connected literally with each other and with nature. You know, well, this is connecting with nature. We think, oh, connect, what sort of, but actually at that point when you realize that we are that ability to kind of, you know, stare across a table from somebody or meet somebody at a coffee bar or shake their hands, give them a hug, you know, these basic things that we take for granted every day, and I hope we're not taking them for granted today. I kind of do think to myself sometimes, you know, that we will, well, it's only a matter of time before we do, but I think those of us who were scarred from that couple of years really will, I think, cherish every handshake and hug that we can give our friends and family, really. In fact, complete strangers, you know, that's whatever it takes, you know, that's the, I'm wondering, you know, in that education, that was interesting, just if we can just zip back to the education side, because maybe I can pick your brains here. We've Julianne, who's actually listening to the call at the moment, she looks after our education side, and we provide a lot of free materials. We're trying to work with the schools and so on, so that we can share some basic things, try and get people engaged and interested in nature. Now, give them something to tick, to circle, to color, and so on. But I'm conscious that, you know, we may inadvertently be missing that person who's you know, feeling a little isolated and maybe has dyslexia. And how can we, as a company, how might we address that? In what would help when we're delivering our educational materials? Do we need to be more, you know, more colorful, more picturesque, less? I don't know. Just something that might help.
Well, from a dyslexia perspective, it's always really good to use, I mean, in the book we use it as well, but dyslexic friendly fonts. And these are actually more accessible for everyone. They're easier on the eyes, whether you have dyslexia or not. So having a dyslexia friendly font is really good for everyone, including people with dyslexia. People like myself will look at it and go, oh, that's not painful to read. And it's really simple. It's just like the kind of the shape of the letters, because dyslexic people read using shapes some of the time. So I look at a shape of a word rather than necessarily the letters, and I will read looking for patterns. So, you know, that's always a really good one. Having enough space on the page is quite important, so not cramming too much in. I always use spacing, you know, on Word and stuff, and you can do 1.5 spacing between your lines. That's really helpful for people like me. you know, not overcomplicating things. I mean, I think probably it actually makes it simple for everyone. You know, not having too many. I mean, colors are great. I color code everything. My highlighter system, if you ever see my notes for Springwatch, you know, I think Chris and Michaela look at them and go, how do you do that? How do you see through it? Because I highlight everything, and it's a complicated color coding system. So, you know, color for me is a good thing, but not too much of like a detailed pattern. So yeah, I mean, it very much depends, but also I think a key thing is to make, you know, your resources accessible to everyone by looking at the way that they're formatted in that way, but also just by looking at, you know, the audience that you're getting them out to. You know, you could, for example, you know, go to particular schools and reach out to those communities and ask how can we get you involved? What would you like to see from us? Sometimes communities like that can be quite insulated and quite, you know, hesitant to reach out because they don't necessarily feel like this is the world for them. So, you know, you have to kind of sometimes put out the olive branch and reach out to people. You know, whether that could be inner city people that don't have access to nature, it could be neurodivergent people, you know, with dyslexia, with autism, ADHD, whatever it may be. But go into those spaces and talk to people and say, you know, what can we do to enhance your connection with nature, to enhance your connection with birds, whatever it may be, and bring you on board with this.
This is one of the reasons we film our podcast now. We just started by with the, you know, recording it originally, and we were asked to film because then that would help neurodivergent, you know, just, you know, helpful to see people. It's not all nature as well. I notice here that you see this celebrity lifestyle starting to seep in here. You've been on Pointless. I mean, that's got to be the mark of a celebrity lifestyle, isn't it? You're now officially a celebrity. Yeah, was it fun? Is it as fun as it looks? Did the wildlife expertise give you any edge?
Simon, you're throwing the C word at me. It makes me highly uncomfortable. I just talk about animals. That's what I do.
Well, it's too late. You've been on Pointless.
I went on Pointless with Chris. We did, this was again kind of in lockdown area, but we were kind of, because we were bubbled together, we could kind of you know, do these shows as one. So we went on Pointless, and I mean, we had a question which I think it was about kind of celebrities' faces. I had lots of different pictures of different celebrities. Again, it's not a word I use very often, but that was the question. And, you know, there were a lot of actresses.
I used it.
Actresses and actresses from EastEnders and Emmerdale. There's, I think, Strictly dancers. And anyway, I didn't really keep up with that kind of stuff. I'm too busy looking at owl pellets to really be inside watching. So my mum watches it all the time. I used to sometimes tune in as a kid. I used to watch Hollyoaks with my dad when I was a teenager. So there's no negative things for people who do watch it, because I kind of, you know, I don't watch it now, but, you know, I know people love it, but I don't keep up to date with actresses and actors. I don't know anyone's names. I don't do this kind of thing. So anyway, obviously the aim of Pointless is to get the most pointless answer. And I knew someone. So I said it and that was fine. But then it was Chris's turn. And I don't know anyone. Chris lives under a rock, and really, you know, I'm barely surprised that he knew one person, although he really should have known them. But he went for the most obvious answer, which was David Attenborough. And I'm not sure he understood the point of it. Everyone, of course, knows David Attenborough, so we were knocked out immediately after that. And I don't let him live that down.
But it gave you more chance to go on and do what you do best, which is help protect nature, highlight the positivity around there, and offer what you've learned to people like me, you know, so that we can kind of, you know, recalibrate ourselves and start thinking a little bit more about the natural world. So that's your strength. You'll have to take the celebrity thing, though, because, you know, the more people recognize you can use your message, you can get to talk to more people. This is just going to have to work in tandem, I'm afraid. You're just going to have to deal with it.
Very grateful to have the, you know,
Chris is amazing as well, isn't he? His memory is just unbelievable.
Yeah,
and we had a lovely podcast with him as well. Yeah,
yeah. He's pretty good at what he does.
Well, I'm going to have to wrap up because I promised you I would. But before you go, can we ask you, because we're going to have to, what birds are you feeding in the garden? Are you feeding the birds in the garden is the first question. But and if so, what's on the feeders and the bird table at the moment?
Absolutely. I always feed my birds. My birds probably eat me out of house and home most of the time because I feed them a lot of sunflower hearts and I have to always keep reordering them. So yeah, at the minute, we've got lots of different things. We've got bullfinches at the minute. So first bullfinch young, which was quite nice the other day. So wow. I'm very lucky to have a pair of bullfinches and their young pottering around. We get lots of coal tits. We also get all the usual suspects. We get robins, lots of siskins at the minute, lots of chaffinches. The other day I looked out on the ground and we had about 50 chaffinches on the ground. Doing pretty well from that respect. So lots of different garden birds come in and causes me gets my curiosity going and causes me no end of entertainment to watch them all.
but it just shows you can get entertainment in your own garden. A very simple thing, really, just looking after and working alongside nature, which is we obviously we feed the birds here. That's the other thing. From a commercial dwelling, we feed the birds because we create bird food, we manufacture bird food, and so on. So people would say we would, but it's amazing how many companies do not and could do. But anyway, that'd be so. I think really as we wrap up, Megan, it's I really enjoyed chatting to you. I just wonder whether you've got any parting words for our nature space enthusiasts. Megan, anything you'd like to leave us with?
Yeah, I would say the biggest thing is my granddad always used to say this to me, actually, and it was really lovely. Before he passed away, he always used to leave me notes around the house just saying, be bad. And he never meant be bad in a naughty way. Don't be like a bad person. That's not what he meant. But he always just meant speak your mind, be honest, and question everything. And I always take those words quite seriously, because it's being cheeky and I'm trying to push things, push the limit. If you've got something to say, or you don't quite believe in something, or you want more of something, talk about it. Stand up for our natural world and use your voice for good, because your voice is important. You might only be one individual, but if we all start talking together, then that is quite a loud voice that can be an advocate for nature.
That's really wise words. I love that. Like a thunderclap. There's an American marketer called Seth Godin, and he says, make a ruckus.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, really. Make a ruckus. Do something. Stand up. Have the courage and conviction to stand up. And you've gone from saving earthworms, as I've said before, to really standing up for nature. And I'm really, I'm so pleased you've taken time to chat with us today. And I know our listeners will be. We'll put some links in the show notes to that book, that lovely book of yours. And probably to your page as well, so people can find out a little bit more about you and maybe offer you some support for your next appearance on Pointless.
Yeah, as long as I'm not prepared with Prince.
We'll find you somebody else to pair with. That's what we'll do. Don't tell Chris that, though. He won't listen. He'll be all right. So really thank you for those contributions. And a note to the listeners, really explore the wonders of the natural world. And remember, as Megan says, really every little counts. And don't go quietly. If you've got something to say and you want to stand up for nature, then Megan's already told you how you might do that. So see you on the next episode. There you go, Megan.